Hello and welcome to another episode of Character Reveal. It's that show where we reveal character about cool people. As always, it's your host Dom, aka Brother Dom, all around the internet. And I'm joined once again by the master of quantum coolness. Would you like to tell the people who you are?
Hello everyone, it is me, Stephanie, aka Captain Steph on Twitter, The Snow Queer on Tumblr, and we are joined by an awesome guest today. Wayne, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, how much time do you have? Hi, I'm Wayne, Wayne Wise. We're in Pittsburgh, work at Phantom of the Attic Comics in Oakland, which is where I met both of you. Been there for 20 years next month.
Congratulations.
Phantom's been on Craig Street in Oakland since 1983. Hi. ambient noise. What do you want to know? I mean, my background. I have undergraduate degrees in history and psychology. I have a master's degree in clinical psychology. I work at a comic shop. One of the most overqualified people to work in a comic shop ever. I'm an author. I'm a cartoonist. I've had stuff published both ways.
So you said you're a publisher. You've published.
Yeah, I've published. I have four novels that I've self-published. The first one I did was called King of Summer. It was published by a small press publisher in 2002. Got the rights back to it a few years ago, and just through Amazon CreateSpace and Kindle Books and self-publishing and all that.
Nice.
Have four of them available. Did some inking for Malibu Graphics, which is a comics company in the mid '90s. Did two miniseries. One was. There was a bad 1950s movie called Invaders from Mars, and in the 80s they did a bad remake of it, and I inked a really bad sequel to the bad remake.
Delightful.
In the mid-90s, Malibu was one of the probably top five publishers, just like what IDW is now, level. And they did a lot of licensed products. So I did that. I did remember the old movie, TV series Alien Nation? I did a miniseries based on that. Both of them were written by, and I'm going to blank on his name right now, Lauren. He's the guy who created Men in Black, which was published by Malibu Graphics at the time.
I think I might have heard of that once or twice.
Yeah. And I never met him at the time. It was all done through the editor. The penciler was Sandy Carruthers, who lives in Canada, who I never met or spoke to back in those days. But he popped up on Facebook through mutual friends 2 or 3 years ago. Uh-huh. So 20 years later, Sandy and I had our first conversation after me inking four issues of his pencils.
Hey, however long it takes to get there.
So
that magical place.
Yeah. So I've been doing comic stuff pretty much forever. Learned to read from comics.
Nice.
I don't remember comics not being part of my life.
Very cool.
Good stuff.
What was your first major comic that you really... we're a fan of?
You know, since they've always been there, it's kind of hard to pick. I grew up reading both Marvel and DC, but I also, Richie Rich and Archie and just anything that was coming out, just comics were just part of it.
Good stuff.
So I was born in 61, so I'm just young enough to have missed the early Marvel, Fantastic Four and all that stuff. But was getting some of that mid-60s stuff. Then I had an older cousin I inherited a box of comics from at one point. So
everybody gets
so that had that Iron Man number one in it and a couple things like
that. So you've seen you've seen the transition of the character from the that bullet bowling ball kind of guy. Well, that's cool. Yeah. It's how do you like the casting of Tony Stark? I mean, that's such an old question, I'm shocked
Robert
by it.
Robert Downey Jr. I mean, as an old fan who's been with Marvel forever, Iron Man has always been sort of a second stringer. Yes, he's in the Avengers. He's always had his own book, but he was never the icon of the Marvel Universe until Robert Downey Jr.
That's interesting.
And he brought that character to life in a way that just had never happened in the comics. There have been some great runs of Iron Man, but boy, he just catapulted the character to the foreground.
Yeah, I wasn't a comics fan when the first movie came out. I actually... given the choice between seeing Iron Man and Speed Racer, which was at the time, we went and saw Speed Racer. I didn't see Iron Man until it was on DVD. But I had never even really heard of Iron Man. It was just and then coming to later and people being like, oh yeah, Iron Man was not a big deal.
It's funny to see that transition. And it works. I mean, I think in many ways, he's a character that people in the modern age can relate to, because it's technology. If I had the money and the technology, I could be mm-hmm. that too.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that's a lot easier for people to wrap their head around than cosmically powered whatever.
Mm-hmm. We got there, though.
Yeah, we got there. But I think in many ways he's a good entry point character for people who don't read comics mm-hmm. because of that.
And he never is actually really like super powered. It's all his own.
Yeah. It's kind of just like some guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, then we got like... It feels like all the Marvel characters that I knew that were just, like, the big names that were out there are all not in the MCU. Like, I mean, Captain America we all know, but Hawkeye, Black Widow, Ant-Man.
Yeah.
I knew, like, the Dexter counterparts. The Guardians, which I guess I read, they weren't really a big deal either.
No, not at all. I saw all those characters growing up. But if you had told me mm-hmm. 10 years ago that Rocket Raccoon would be on the big screen before Wonder Woman, just how absurd is that?
We can go down that rabbit hole for a while, and
even in comics like Annihilation and the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff that Dan Abnett wrote like 10, 12, probably 15 years ago now, not quite that long,
mm-hmm.
that's what brought those characters back, and he did some really, really good space, cosmic adventure stuff with them, but that was such a big chance on the part of Marvel to do that, and they pulled it off.
Yeah,
and I think some of it, they were smart, because it's a fun adventure sci-fi movie, but they played up the humor elements of it without it mm-hmm. being slapstick.
Yeah.
And you've got, a talking raccoon in a tree. They kind of have to play up the humor.
Yeah, you have to lean into that.
Yeah.
It seems like most of their casting, at least with the male characters, was all, like, random. Like, you have Chris Pratt, who's, like, a comedy guy. Yeah. Vin Diesel as Groot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Dave Bautista as Drax. And then Bradley Cooper, I think.
Yeah, Bradley Cooper.
Yeah. So, like, it was all just kind of funny in its conception that they're, like, whatever, just go see this, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
So, it is a shame that Rocket Raccoon got to the big screen before Wonder Woman. Not even as a side character, like, literally in general.
I was, like, there was a while ago, like, when the first Guardians movie came out, they were like, oh my gosh, Marvel's got a talking raccoon on TV, and DC still hasn't made a movie with a female lead character. And I was like, Marvel hasn't either.
Marvel hasn't either. So... Yeah.
Has Black Widow been in the most movies in the MCU, though?
Yeah.
One can make the argument.
You can make the argument that,
like, the stars of the MCU are a black man and a white woman. You could make that claim. And only kind of slightly be reaching a little bit. How did, do you really know how Deadpool came into, like, the huge cultural phenomenon that he
is? No, I don't.
Okay.
kind of boggles me.
Because I knew him from like TV Tropes articles, but then Marvel versus Capcom 3, he was there, and then everyone loved him.
I have thoughts of that, and I think the video games, the appearances, I don't play a lot of video games. It's one of those things that it's an addiction I know I can't afford, because I know, like, I have too many hobbies.
Comics is already that problem.
Yeah, I have too many hobbies, so it's one that I know from the few I've played that I could just live here if I let myself,
smart decision.
But because of that, I'm unaware of how much the public exposure of a lot of these characters to people who don't read comics. You know, mm-hmm. the people who know this stuff who have never set foot in a comic shop or picked up a comic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of it. That character became popular there.
That's how I know X-23 is from that game. I never picked up a comic and I'm like, oh, it's X-23, Laura Kinney, and she has all these powers.
Now, Deadpool was introduced during a period... I mean, while I've always read comics, the biggest gap in my comics reading of mainstream and lack of knowledge is late 80s through the mid 90s, when Image was coming out, when all that stuff was blowing mm-hmm. up. I was still going to comic shops, but things like Watchmen and Dark Knight, the stuff from 1986, this explosion of comics and, mm-hmm. and comics being more adult and more real and whatever, there was so much really good stuff that came out at that point that mm-hmm. it kind of ruined superheroes for me for a while, because I'd seen really, really good stuff followed by just mediocre superhero stuff. So that was the period I was most reading all the indie stuff that was coming out at the time. I never gave up Marvel and DC entirely, but boy, mm-hmm. did I cut back on that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and then when I started working at a comic shop, I worked at New Dimension Comics, another local chain, for a year before I started at Phantom. And just being full-time in a comic shop, seeing the stuff, got me reading it again.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
it's easier to keep up with a lot more stuff when you're not paying for
absolutely. Yes, I have that side benefit. It's my job to read these.
I have to be familiar with these.
I need to know.
Gotta tell the customers.
But Deadpool and Cable and a lot of that stuff were introduced during that time period. So while I was aware of them, I wasn't reading them. But and this is my age. I mean, I know so many people who are your age, just a little bit older, who started reading comics with Todd McFarlane, Spider-Man, and, you know, like Spawn and Image and all that stuff. And just love it. And, you know, I looked at that stuff at the time and thought, this is terrible.
<What's> terrible.
There's no story here. You know, it was Image versus Substance. You know, especially like after things like Dark Knight and Watchmen and some of these things that really had felt like a lot more substance. But I recognize the stuff that turns you on to comics stays your favorite forever.
Sure.
So there's that generation who grew up with that stuff and they love it, and good.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my place to take that away from you if that's the stuff you love. Mm-hmm. But it was during a period that I just was not into it at all.
It just seems odd because it seems like a lot of people that love Deadpool also weren't reading comics at that time. I mean, myself included. Yeah. You know.
But it's funny because that period of comics, if I lean back and you can't get me over,
I'll just adjust real quick.
For whatever feelings I had about comics at the time, from a purely business practical point of view, comics sold better in that time period than they had in 50 years or since.
Uh-huh.
So whatever my aesthetics feelings about those comics are, from a purely commercial point of view, they're the most successful comics of the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I know? So what do I know? But Deadpool started out... You know, there's always been that element of crazy, but it seems like he started out as more, you know, the mercenary and the violent and the ultra-violence, and somewhere along the line, he became a comedic parody character.
Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't start as kind of like the...
Yeah.
Goofy.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly when or how that transition took place, but I find that kind of fascinating. And I guess what kind of bothers me in comics with the character now is... They still try to do both. When Deadpool was appearing in X-Force a few years ago, X-Force was the dark underbelly of the mutant universe where they're going on secret missions and everybody on the team is a dark killing machine kind of thing. And he's there and he's being crazy, but they're still doing the serious thing.
Mm-hmm. And so it's just like totally...
Yeah, and then in his own book, he's still sort of this parody character breaking the fourth wall and that sort of thing. So I have a tough time reconciling those two things. In my own head.
Mm-hmm.
But it works for somebody.
It definitely is an interesting thing to see, like, this dark world going on around him. And he's participating in it. But also, like, because this is a comic book after all.
Yeah.
Like, this is all fake.
And commenting on it. Well, I didn't see the movie when it came out. I waited. It was on cable. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw it a year after it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully admit some of my reticence to go see it. It was like, oh, it's Deadpool. I've hated this character. And then I really enjoyed the movie, and because it was fun. You know, it wasn't meant to be anything other than what it was, and that was fine. So
I saw a video essay talking about how some movie companies did learn a good lesson from Deadpool. Mm-hmm. Rather than just saying make it R rated and be ridiculous, they're like, we can do something lower budget, give the R rating cushion, but like break the genre. And then like Logan kind of solidified that it was more. Like of a serious take.
Yeah,
kind of
it was definitely more adult, but you know, it didn't have the comedic elements to it. Yeah.
And it still did pretty well from what I'm saying. So I mean, maybe we'll see a lot more of like good adaptations rather than trying to
whatever you can at the wall.
Well, and if the R rating is just purely, oh look, more sex and violence, then that doesn't do anything either. So there needs to be more content. Once again, it comes back to that Image versus Substance thing that I said.
Yeah, I think Wolverine's a good candidate for that because he's in these like PG-13 movies, but his main weapon is these titanium claws.
Yeah.
Like, how's he fighting people without having a lot of bloodshed?
Yeah.
It kind of doesn't fit, so I think he was a good addition.
And that's always been one of the back when Wolverine, in the early days of Wolverine and the X-Men. I bought X-Men Hulk 181 off the stands. I was buying Hulk at the time. So, yeah, I had that first appearance of Wolverine and liked the character a lot. I bought Giant Size X-Men number 1 because he was on the cover and had a subscription to X-Men starting with, like, issue 98, which was, it started again with 94.
Mm-hmm.
So I was early X-Men fan. And that first few years of that, I would say there's never been a run of superhero comics I've been more genuinely invested in at any given time in my life than I was that series
that
right
particular.
Then. Up through about the end of when Paul Smith was on the book. He was on for about a year. And then after that, my interest in life started going other places. I didn't stop buying it, of course, because that's what you do in comics. You keep buying it. Yeah. Which keeps me in food and whatever. So, yay.
Hey, we're doing like a nice on-location recording. So I'm looking around and seeing like all kinds of like cool comic stuff. And it's like it's a nice space for this sort of thing.
I'm obsessive over books, and those are toys from my childhood, and so yeah, all kinds like of stuff.
The Hello Kitty, is that a?
That was a birthday present. Yeah, it's Kiss Hello Kitty.
See, this is why I want to have bookshelves. It's not for the mass amount of books that I don't have, but more for like all the other things, like the figures.
Other stuff.
So you've seen I'm just jumping all over the place.
Yeah, that's informal. Cool.
So you've seen the rise and fall of Beanie Babies and now the rise of Funko Pops. I mean, so did we, but you were actually a doll at that time, yeah. So it wasn't just something.
Mm.
How do you feel about like these Funko Pop figures?
I have a couple, obviously. I'm not real, real into the whole super deformed mm-hmm. kind of take on characters. I mean, they're fun, yeah, and mm-hmm. if people dig them, great.
Yeah, that's another thing that people buy.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, we saw them at the store. It pays my rent. So. But yeah, you're right. Those fads, like, you know, in the 90s, something you've probably never heard of, there was this game called Pogs.
Oh, well, I know about Pogs.
You know about Pogs? Okay.
I know about Pogs.
Okay. All right. And there was a time Pogs were just, they were going to save the industry. This is the most collectible thing in the world. And a year later, nobody cared.
Yeah.
So it is kind of fascinating from the retail end to see those fads come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And slipping into retailer mode for a minute, just talking to other retailers, there's so much of that, what's hot right now, how do we cash in on this
mm-hmm.
as a business model? And, you know, at Phantom, we're much more for the long con. We try to build readers rather than collectors. Like, mm-hmm. if you're genuinely interested in what Hawkeye's doing next month, you're going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Whereas if you're buying something as a collectible that you feel is going
like,
to be worth something someday.
Like some number ones or something.
Yeah.
To...
And then a year from now, the bottom drops out of that market. And you bring them back and trying to sell them to us, and we don't give you anything for them.
They're going to be kind of upset.
Yeah, yeah. And,
as if that's your fault.
And if that was your motivation for buying and investing in this stuff, you're going to go on and find the next thing to buy and invest in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you become a fan of the content, you keep coming back.
Right. Yeah.
So that's been our long business model. And I think, you know, we've probably missed out on some quick get rich fads that we could have capitalized on more and made more money on. That said, Phantom's been on the street since 1983, so you know we're doing something.
You're doing something right.
Staying there. Yeah, yeah. So and you know it's an ongoing challenge to try to stay on top of not just the fad stuff, but how is the industry changing and what can we do to to grapple with that. We were one of the first stores anywhere I knew who really went graphic novels are the big thing. They're gonna be the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And started investing more in graphic novels. We were going to Pittsburgh Comic Con 15 years ago. With a bookshelf we built and would show up with graphic novels, we'd be the only people in the room with graphic novels.
Hmm.
We'd sell 5 copies of Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
Watchmen.
Yeah.
Like, there's a Barnes & Noble you can go to for free across the parking lot, and you came here to buy Watchmen. Thank you.
Thanks for the
And, you know, people coming in and saying, you know, we'd have Sandman. Uh-huh. Once again, Sandman.
Yeah.
And people are like, I can't find this anywhere.
Really?
What? But 15 years ago, a lot of comic shops just were simply not keeping that stuff in stock because they didn't know. It had never been part of the business in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's something that we were on top of and did really well for a long time. And you've been to our store. You see you know, how much space we dedicate to graphic novels. And
mm-hmm.
when we moved from our old space, we used to be over where the game store is.
Yeah, I remember. I was there once.
Yeah, and just like the front half of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we had what was essentially a bookshelf of graphic novels. And when we were building out the new space, which was a far too long process that made us all crazy, we wanted
Bowls,
bookshelves.
Yeah.
And Jimmy and I walked over one day if the bookshelves were finished just to see the space. And we're looking at these bookshelves like, oh my God, how are we going to fill these? And here it is almost 9 years later. It's like, oh my God, where do we put all these graphic novels? You know? We could use this many more bookshelves. So
good problem to have.
Yeah. But yeah, say the business does change. Like, you know, how, not just, I mean, clientele changes. We have, we're lucky in a couple ways. We have a lot of our old-time customers. The people who spend the most money per week in our store is the guy who's been shopping there for 30 years, who has a good job and just has always done this. But the student population, being sandwiched between Pitt and CMU and then Carlo and Chatham, we have that turnover.
Yeah.
Every last week of August, we get 6,000 new students who have never read Watchmen or Sandman or whatever. So there's that turnover of new customers coming in, and we get to know them. That's funny because, you know, it's, we right now this week, I will be losing people I've known for the last 4 years and gotten to know and gotten very close to.
That is wild to think.
You know,
about.
And then the last week of August, I will start seeing faces that I don't know at all that in 4 years I will really miss.
It was so weird when Jimmy sent me all my comics that, like, that he was building up over the summer, and it was like, thanks for being a customer for so many years. And I was like, oh my God, so many years. Like, I've been doing this for like 5 years already.
You guys stayed my, you're the comic shop that I go to despite the fact that I was at Pitt, and then I moved back to Marianna, which was like an hour and a half away, and I'm like, man, my backlog is really building up. Like, every few months, I just go pick up a bunch of stuff until one time I'm like, you know, guys, you don't got to pull these from me. And then now I live somewhere else, and I'm still like, there's comic shops that are closer. I'm like, well, that's not the one I'm going to go to. Phantom is there.
Well, and we appreciate that. We seem to build a tremendous amount of loyalty, and I think some of that is the customer service. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... we all take that very seriously. I know, as a customer, before I worked in a store, Phantom was my store because Jeff knew my name and treated me well and got to know my taste and recommended stuff. And, you know, there's the old cliche of cranky comic shops, and it's a cliche for a reason because there are a lot of them out there. And just, you know, because it's a hobby. It's not just a commodity. I think we all see it that way. Yes, this is how we make our living. But like I say, it's about building readers rather than a commodity.
It's not like you like sell comics during the day and then come home and do something completely
different.
Something you're invested in.
And it's also, it's community. You know, like there's a fan base and you build a community. Everybody who walks through that door has something in common with me. Even if we disagree on specifics, the fact that you're there in the first place.
Yeah, that was one of the things I always really appreciated about Phantom, is because I was so nervous the first time I went up there to start my list. Like, I was like, because I had heard all the horror stories, especially about women going into comic book shops and getting, like, treated like garbage. And I was like, I don't think that they're going to be like this. Like, I'm going to have faith, but I'm so nervous. And I was like, I open the door and the bell goes off, so they know that someone's
watching this. I can't sneak in.
You know, walk up that long staircase.
We're watching. We try, we're conscious of that. I mean, that's been such a change in the industry. As an old guy who does comics, I remember going to Mid-Ohio Con in Mansfield, Ohio, back in the mid-80s with my girlfriend at the time. And she pointed out she was one of 10 women in the room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 8 of them were there with their boyfriends.
Better than the vape convention.
And that changeover of far more, you know, the female readership growing and expanding, I see as such an incredibly positive thing. I love comics. I want everybody to love comics, you know?
Even purely from a cynical standpoint, that's
more money.
I mean, from a cynical point of view, there's that. I've read so many comics, and so many of them have been the same, and if I wasn't working in it, I wonder what I would be reading. Bringing in that diversity of voices in the creators as well as the audience, it changes the content. And I think that's important. For any art form to grow, it needs to evolve and change. And it can only evolve and change if you're bringing in different voices than the people who have always done it. So I see that as a positive thing from the viewpoint of the customer base, from the viewpoint of the people creating comics. It creates a broader base of content. You know, like, late 70s, if you read Marvel and DC, that was it. You know, like, that was the breadth of stuff that happened.
You didn't like superheroes.
Yeah, and there were exceptions happening in what was becoming the direct market at that time. The things like ElfQuest that was starting to happen. But it was few and far between. And now, you know, you walk into a store, and yes, Marvel, DC are still the bread and butter of the business.
Mm-hmm. But you can walk into a comic shop and not walk out with any Marvel and DC.
You can spend $200
and not. Yeah, and I really think if you like to read, I will find you something mm-hmm. in comics.
Whatever it is you like to read, whatever it is, a comic book for you.
There might only be one thing, but I'll find. But that's changing, too. I say bringing those voices in, it mm-hmm. is. It's making the diversity wider. And that's the way that's changing the market, the amount of books that are coming out through alternate distribution systems, things like Tumblr, people finding ways mm-hmm. to self-publish, Kickstarter, stuff that's not being carried by the major distributor, mm-hmm. book publishers starting to do graphic novels rather than just comics companies doing graphic novels. It makes it, in some ways, more difficult for us to stay on top of everything that's coming mm-hmm. out.
Because there's this coming from everywhere.
So much. And, you know, and a lot of the stuff, like Tumblr stuff and Kickstarter stuff, it's self-published. It mm-hmm. never shows up in our catalogs.
Yes, it's...
We don't
small
know about
runs,
it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it makes, in some ways, it makes the job more difficult, but it so broadens the potential base of people who mm-hmm. can read and buy comics that just, I see all that as such a positive thing.
And even if, like, if you don't get, like, the specific Kickstarter graphic novel or whatever in your store, like, someone might come in and say, I read this and I loved it.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else that is similar?
And that happens, like, yes, absolutely. Yeah. But we've always tried to be welcoming. You know, mm-hmm. we've never wanted to be that cranky comic shop.
Yeah.
That's such a cliche. In spite of the fact that we're all old fat guys with beards, we try not to be the cliche comic shop.
I mean, you guys have there's definitely a nice air of welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember for quite a while, you did have that section that was like, hey, there's comics for women.
Yeah,
I think that's
like
a queer comic section.
Annalena, who worked there, mm-hmm. Put that shelf up.
Yeah,
we now have a shelf that is very specifically queer comics that mm-hmm. Zora has
put up.
Yeah, we've talked with Zora a few times on the show.
Yeah.
They're really cool. So it is nice to see that, I without knowing anything about the store at the time, like, I don't know these people at all, but at least they're trying to, like, reach out to other mm-hmm. groups. And then, I mean, I found my way to Sonic Comics, and I was good. I'm like, good, this is why I'm here. But I'm one of those loved licensed comic people, but, you know, it's all comics.
Sure. Dig what you did.
Sonic, Mega Man, Rick and Morty. That's the one thing that is intimidating about the comic store is that, oh my god, I could drop so much money here. Like, I have to stay laser focused, or I'm going to, like, be missing some zeros off my uh-huh. paycheck at the end of the week. I had.
No, yeah, I just, like, I always, Midtown does their pull lists online, mm-hmm. and so, like, I always look at it, like, every week I spend, like, $20 to $40 at the comic book store, and I'm like, I live in New York, I can't do this. I come home, I look at the list, I'm like, I can't cut any of these. I have to know.
There is... And that is, it's tough. There's a high barrier of entry, and particularly mm-hmm. Marvel and DC, in terms of trying to figure out
where to start.
And at, you know, $3.99 a pop, it's not a cheap hobby. And I think this is a place where both Marvel and DC I don't think it's a good business idea. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Marvel is relaunching, quote unquote, the X-Books. Okay. We have X-Men Gold and X-Men Blue.
Like Pokemon?
But it's a line. And, you know, uh-huh. so they want you to be interested in mutant-related books. Here are 12 of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, the fucking the U.S. Avengers, Midtown had all 50 covers. Like...
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there was a cover for each state with an Avenger assigned to each state.
Yes. That's nifty if you have, like, a favorite Avenger or a state that you like.
Yeah.
But...
or you have $1 billion
to
invest in.
Or, yeah, if you're trying
comics.
To collect all 50
yeah.
because you're a collector.
And that whole variant thing as well. We have a tough time wrapping our head around that
the
as a business.
Yeah.
Like, we get some, but we don't really participate in that market
yeah.
very much. And I know some stores, they'll order the 500 copies to get
that one variant,
and they will sell it online at a tremendous profit.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still paying for those 500 copies.
Yeah.
So subtract
yeah.
that from what you've sold it for. How much profit did you actually make?
Yeah.
And now you have 500 copies of this comic cluttering up your store.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you sell them at $1 a piece or something, okay.
Yeah.
There's so many pieces of that.
That could take, like, 500 days.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. I mean, if like, it's a 1 in 50 cover and our normal orders are 45, okay,
maybe,
we'll
yeah.
do it. You know? And we have some people who will ask for them, but we don't go crazy with
yeah,
that
Yeah, like,
stuff.
I'll grab them, like, sometimes, like, if a... Like, because Midtown does such a, like, ludicrous amount of sales, like, they usually have most of the variant covers, and so, like, if I see what I like it, then I get it. Mm-hmm. Like, I was really excited that America Number One had the Hamilton-inspired cover, so I was like, I told the guy at the shop, I was like, you have to put this aside for me.
And I get that, from a collector's point of view, if it's something that the image really speaks to you, I get mm-hmm. that wanting it kind of thing.
But I'm not going to collect all of them.
Yeah,
like,
and even, I mean, if you check out the eBay stuff, that first week something comes out, prices jump, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. immediately drop.
Yeah.
So if you're doing it for investment purposes that first week, I don't know that it's a real good investment strategy.
That's at least like a 20-year strategy.
And we don't know how that stuff will hold up over the long haul, because there are variant covers that were coming out in the 90s that nobody cares about anymore.
But throws me off also, because there's also variant covers during a series, which could really throw things off. I mean, just with the Sonic ones, every now and then they'll do like a run where it's, if you line them up, it's a mural. So, like, oh, you have them jumping around, and then a variant cover, and then back to the normal, like, okay, well, I could go back and buy the regular one, but on a pool list, like, maybe if you read an obscure comic,
that's like, the only one.
Okay, now I have something that's out of sequence, and a variant that nobody wants, so it's good. Any collecting I wanted to do.
And we have a handful of customers who are interested in them, and every once in a while there'll be a cover solicited that somebody will ask us about. Mm-hmm. And if we can, we'll do it. You know, we try to take care of our customers, and really, for our regulars, we really don't jack the price up either. We just, mm-hmm. you know, because we've paid the same for it as everything else.
Mm-hmm.
There's that, once again, this is going to sound mercenary, but there's some truth to it. You take care of your regulars. You make them happy, and you build customer loyalty. And in the long term, that customer loyality pays off so much more than an extra
$10. The long run, if you don't gouge them.
Yeah,
I mean, that happens at bars, too. You know, RIP Qdoba Bar, but the local bar we went to, we tipped them so much on drinks that were already underpriced to the point that they might give us something free pretty frequently, but it's like, you dropped like $100 last week.
Yep.
So, take care of your customers, they'll be there forever.
But we also, with any of the variants, it's tough for us to guarantee anything for anybody. Mm-hmm. We had a guy, he's been coming in for years, but he's never been a subscriber, you know, he stops in irregularly. And recently there was, I think it was X-Men Blue number one. There was a Kirby-like variant.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted that. We had one. We sold it to him for $3.99. He was thrilled. He called this week looking for, there's a variant on the first issue of Jean Grey that is like the Dave Cockrum original appearance of Phoenix tribute cover. And it's like a 1 in 500 cover. And you're not getting that. that's the way
you gotta call and ask, though.
And that's it. And I told him, you call. We can't guarantee it, but
call and ask. We can always
There are some really weird practices that go on. Like, I came in looking for that Sonic Mega Man crossover, and I look at the back and I'm like, why are half of these missing? Like, they pulled everything for me. And I turn it over, and like, hey, during your time off, we released another franchise. Yeah. Also, gotta subscribe to that. And I'm like, So I came to local. Yeah. I'm like, do you guys happen to have these? And I'm like, I'm gonna have to just read those two. Like, I'm gonna go to online retailer. Cause I couldn't find physicals online. Yeah. I'm like, this doesn't exist anywhere. Yeah. Nobody reads this. So
I, even myself, there's the new Love and Rocket series that's coming out. Mm-hmm. It's magazine format again. And Love and Rocket is one of my all-time favorite books of the last 30-some years. That's really tough for me to turn new people on to because it's such a long-running thing. But there was the main cover, which showed Jaime's primary cast on the cover, just sitting, you know, as they look now. You know, like because he's allowed his characters to age. Mm-hmm. There's a variant cover you see on the inside cover of, it's the exact same shot of them young.
Oh, okay.
So, and like, I so want both of those covers, and I can't find the other one anywhere. I looked online, I looked on eBay.
It's always odd, is like, when you, like, I understand if you find something, like, super jacked up price on eBay, but I'm like, I can't even find, like,
this one I can't even version find. Of this. Yeah.
People really want to just keep this. And, that takes us back to those Funko Pops. I'm not buying them to sell them. Like, I bought it because
I bought it and I took it out of the box and I put it on my desk. Like, I want to look at this.
Well, we got an email just this week down at Spirit Lounge down here in Lawrenceville.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Funko Pop show sometime in May, and they invited us to come over, like $40 a table, but that's what they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
We carry some. Do we have enough to set up all day and bring them over? But then, and our thought with conventions, we haven't done one for a while. Some of that is conventions are changing, and what is our stock, what's selling, what do we take? But there's that side benefit of, oh, here's a whole audience of people buying Funko Pops who might not know we exist. Mm-hmm. So is it worth $40 and my time to go over there on a Saturday afternoon to advertising the store? Mm-hmm. So we haven't made a decision yet, but it's possible I'll bring a carload of Funko Pops over to Lawrenceville one
day. It's like, yeah, I'm not really here to sell Funko Pops. Yeah. I mean, I am,
here's a flyer for the store. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's a smart business move. Like, again, yeah. That builds, I guess, not a reader of Funko Pops, but someone who's collecting them to have rather than to sell.
Yeah, you know? But if it gets them in the store, they may see other things. Like if they don't know the entire comics world exists, and a lot of people don't, just getting them into the store. Free comic book day is so good. Here's a place you can come
to buy these as opposed to going to Barnes & Noble or Walmart or whatever. Like,
yeah, so.
Jumping back to what Dom said, how do you feel, like, as on the, from the retailer side? I know that as a customer of comics, I'm exhausted by crossover events.
Yep. Yep. I see that. I'm exhausted as a retailer with it. But part of that exhaustion comes from the customer base as well. Mm-hmm. Dan Didio from DC, a few years ago, saw an interview where he said, and I get this, they are a business.
Yeah.
He said, you know, I see online all the time people complaining about crossover events. But I can show you the numbers that every time we do one, the numbers go up. So as long as you're still buying them, we're going to keep doing them.
Even if you're pissed off about what happens.
Yeah, so as a business, that's a completely legitimate, their numbers say crossover sell. Mm-hmm. My perception in talking to our customers is you all feel held hostage.
Yeah, like Spider-Gwen had like the crossover. Like, I had to buy a Spider-Man to know what happened.
Yeah,
like...
yeah, you want a complete story, and they do a crossover event that affects the main story you're reading, you feel you have to buy it whether you're interested in it or not. I flat up tell you, 95% of the people who bought Civil War II in our store didn't give a shit about Civil War II.
Yeah. I didn't.
And kind of griped about it.
Mm-hmm. I didn't buy the like actual Civil War II comic, but all it was crossing over in Captain Marvel Miss Marvel and everything else, and
their numbers are good because of that. And here's the thing with the retail is their numbers look good. That's not sell through to customers.
I was gonna say that's the store buying.
That's it. Marvel sees their numbers by what Diamond has sold to retailers. Mm-hmm. So if I buy 500 copies of something to get that one variant cover, all Marvel sees is you bought 500 copies. Yeah. Right. Even though I have 498 of them in the back room in a box. So those numbers are always inflated. So they're the numbers that Marvel or DC or whoever is looking at has nothing to do with how many copies have gone to readers.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. Now, our crossover events, are they normally like a separate book that you have to buy, or is that like part of a different run? Or
depends on how big they are.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, usually like with Civil War II, the upcoming, the Secret Empire thing that just started. Yeah. there's the main series here. You can buy Secret Empire, but they'll put that brand on every other book they publish for 3 months that are crossovers. And you know, like Crisis on Infinite Earths, way back in the day, which is one of the first big crossovers, and one of the ones that was branded that way. Mm-hmm. It was like Crisis Crossover. You'd see that on the book. And like there's an issue of Wonder Woman where the entire crossover was, oh, the skies are red today. What's up with that?
That's terrible.
And that was the crossover.
It ties in. That's awful. Yeah, like, it was so weird, like, cause, when they were doing Battle World, or like the lead up to like Last Days, like, it was kind of there in Ms. Marvel, and, like, then, like, Squirrel Girl was like, what's Secret War? Secret War? Yeah. It's like...
One of my favorites of that was the very first Secret Wars back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Walt Simonson was doing his classic run on Thor. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was one of the best-selling Thor runs that there'd ever been. And he'd been building the story, and then he gets this editorial dictate, oh, by the way, Thor's gonna be lost on Battle World for a year.
What?
and it was one of the best ways of dealing with it whatsoever. Like, he had to do a crossover. So the Thor Secret Wars crossover was, there's a panel of Thor doing whatever it was Thor was doing in his story, and he disappears. Taken away to Secret Wars. Yeah. He reappears in the next panel. And the people standing around him are like, Thor, what happened? Where were you? And Thor's response was, nowhere significant. Footnote, see Secret Wars 1, 2 through 12. And Simonson went on with his story.
Masterful.
That's beautiful.
That is masterful.
Yeah. Yep.
The people that care will go look, and the people that are like, that was weird, whatever.
And I think creators get really tired of of these crossover events, too.
Because, like, you build a story, and then you have to interrupt it
Yeah. And then when they start collecting these, it wasn't as big a deal back in the day, but if you're building this stuff to be collected in trade paperback, reading the trade, the DC, Black as Night trade paperback, it was an 8-issue series, but a significant chapter of the story took place between issues 4 and 5 in an issue of Green Lantern. So if you pick up the Black as Night trade paperback, you are missing a significant chapter of the story.
They didn't include
it. Because they didn't include it in that. It's in this Green Lantern trade paperback over here. That's bad planning. That's bad marketing.
That's bad organization, too. Because you think, like, I know that there are certain trades that I've read that have, like, if the story happens in a different series, they'll put that issue in.
They just released the Marvel's Epic Collections. They just did a new printing of the early new X-Men stuff with Claremont and Cockrum and Byrne. Chris Claremont was writing Iron Fist at the time, and there was a crossover with Iron Fist. It's where Sabretooth was first introduced, and then the X-Men come back from the Shi'ar galaxy for the first time. And they're also drawn by John Byrne, and by golly, his Epic Collection just slots them in right where they belong. Good. That's great.
It's almost mean, like, being mean to your customers to leave it out. Like, you're just like, hey, screw you.
Yeah.
These were the ones I like. They were done pretty well. Whenever you want to buy the trade, they're like, well, you can buy all the trades of Sonic and Mega Man separately, but for that event, it's just going to be its own one. Like,
And that's the way to do that.
I mean, even when they released the other Sonic one, it didn't seem like it was that cynical. Like, they were just doing that anyway. And I'm like, well, if you're already subscribed to this, you might as well get part of it. But then the events, like, the books are already good anyway, so I didn't mind being subscribed to them.
Yeah.
The weird thing was, in the Mega Man universe, like, this didn't happen, this was just an event for fan service. Like, if you didn't read it, it's fine. But the Sonic universe, like, that absolutely...
Yeah.
Something happened, but you only need the last issue of the Sonic one to keep up.
And that's a case of, it was two books that crossed over. With Marvel,
they're both Archie, 40,
you know. But that burnout... Well, this recent conversation, the guy from Marvel who made the comment about that diversity, which was a stupid comment, but I also think it was also taken way out of context. But he was, things he was talking about was, the best-selling book was Spider-Man number whatever it was, that was $9.99. Yes, your numbers are higher on that because it costs more than twice what it normally does.
Like, duh.
So, duh, that doesn't mean... If you make every book $9.99,
people are going to keep buying it.
Every Spider-Man customer we have who buys that book regularly, we're pissed off at the $9.99 cover price to get the next chapter of this story plus some backup features they didn't care about. They bought it because they're reading the story, but they weren't happy about it. So that's mistreating your customers. Yes, your numbers went up.
Yeah,
and as a business, that's what you're looking for.
But you can't be mercenary to the people who are keeping you alive.
And it's also like
our numbers in the store. Our numbers in the store, like, we do the inventory of what we sell every month, and that's how we figure out our orders. We sold one copy more of that than we normally do. And that one or two copy variance means nothing in our store. It wasn't because it was a special issue.
Everyone who was subscribed to it bought it, and someone who was curious.
Someone who normally shops at Ides, they ran out and they came to our store. That sort of thing happens.
How do you feel about this Secret Empire event? I mean, this is going to be dated by the time this comes out, but it's worth having the discussion regardless.
It's going on way too long.
So long.
I mean, and that's
it's been
the
a year
I have
since
with
the first Hydra thing.
Oh wow.
So yeah, that's the biggest problem I have with it. As a story idea. I'm not as upset with it as a lot of people are. I get that Spencer was trying to do... He was trying to make some commentary on current events. Last summer when that first happened, there was an element of that backlash against Sam Wilson being Captain America, and, Captain America, and there were the racist elements that surrounded that. And Nick Spencer, I saw it as a tweet or an article or whatever, but he's like, he's not your Captain America. Okay, let me give you a Nazi Captain America then. All your comments are racist, if that's what you think America is, let me just do
that guy.
So, all right, okay, that's clever, and that's making a political statement that I can get behind.
I think, but it's there's so much that you can see from all, like, all these different factors, and if you just look at that part of it, like, oh, you don't like this black-ass Captain America, we'll make the original Captain America Nazi in a vacuum.
Yeah.
That works in a vacuum.
Right, right. But, if you but now it's become, out, now it's crossed over into every book they're doing, and I guess, I mean, one of the issues I was having with it, and I guess the, and I haven't been reading it closely, it's kind of lost me.
Yeah.
That sounds like a familiar
story. Yeah, I'm flipping through every issue. but, and I guess the most recent issue tried to address this, but Cosmic Cube rewrote history to where he was recruited as a child to be a Hydra agent.
Mm-hmm.
So every story he's ever appeared in, he's been a Hydra agent, which means yeah, every book coming out from Marvel right now is an alternate timeline.
Yeah, like it rewrites the entirety of Marvel history.
If you're reading Spider-Man, which has nothing to do with Secret Empire, it's an alternate history of Spider-Man.
Now, whenever Kopic decides to rewrite this again. Like,
right, yeah. So, you know, like, and how, from the beginning, it's like, how invested can I get in this when, as a long-term reader, I fully believe this too shall pass?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be fixed, that there will be no lasting consequences to this.
Yeah.
But then yesterday, one of our customers was telling me that in the most recent issue, they didn't change the entire universe, just Cap's memories of everything. Okay, that addresses that somewhat.
Still crap.
But yeah, it's still, it feels unnecessarily convoluted. And
yeah, like, it just...
Misjudged some backlash and wanted to, like, get ahead of it. It was like, maybe this is just going on in a different way. Then. Well,
And I don't understand Marvel's marketing with it. And some of it, because of the current political climate, has become more of an issue than it was a year ago.
Yeah, like, so that maybe they had that in, like, on the books, like, to do.
And I think that's some of it, because they do. They plan stuff way, way in advance and start that stuff. And changing a midstream can be difficult for them, particularly when you're doing it in every book in your line.
Oh, yeah.
But the whole, and this came up too, the whole, you know, free comic book day, and here, wear your Hydra t-shirt, the retailer's thing, and the backlash against that.
Maybe it wasn't the greatest idea.
Yeah, and honest to God, as a retailer, I never saw that. My guess is that came in as an email from Diamond that Dave saw and went, yeah, no. And that was the extent of it.
I was going to put the kibosh on that right away.
So, but that just seems like, okay, you're marketing the Secret Empire thing, and Cap's a Hydra agent, and to market that, you're going to market the Hydra side of it, like, as opposed to the Resistance
side.
Like,
the Resistance to that? Like,
yeah, so that just seems like a real misstep.
Come up with, like, a logo or something for, like, the Resistance side?
Yeah.
Like, even, like, a broken Captain America shield, or just something that people are like, oh, what happened to Cap?
Yeah.
Like, let me see what happened.
Yeah. You know, asking, you know, the retailers to dress up as Hydra agents or whatever, like, no.
Oh, no.
It's, like, a little tone deaf.
Yeah.
They're the bad guys, and the average person...
Like, even if Hydra weren't, like, so thoroughly Nazi-aligned,
they're,
like...
They're still the bad guys.
Yeah. Like,
and
not like cool
like,
bad guys, like...
Not like Team
Empire
Rocket,
and,
where it'd be funny.
Like, yeah.
Well, in the Sam Wilson book, one of the first things he comes up against is the Sons of the Serpent, which is a long-term analog for the Ku Klux Klan. You know, it's a racist organization. First Black Panther story I ever read in my life, he was fighting the Sons of the Serpent in issue of Avengers that were racist characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, once again, Nick Spencer trying to deal with the racist stuff going on in this country, the fact that there are organizations, the fact that we have KKK people in the high office now and everybody's okay with it.
Yeah.
He's trying to comment on it, but boy, so much it just feels so clumsy.
Yeah.
I think that's
like,
what it is that,
like,
it's clumsy and
it's
then
clumsy,
you won't admit it.
Yeah, and like, I think there's like, he's doing some reactionary stuff to like, that is not in good taste.
Yeah.
I think like the issue where like the social justice warriors attacked Sam Wilson, I was like...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So you wrote this, and someone signed off on it, and then another person signed off on it.
And I also see what you were trying to do. That's a
I see what you wanted to do,
but that's not what came out on the page.
And trying to be balanced. And the people with, oh, keep your politics out of my comics. Well, you know, Cap started his career punching the Nazi.
Comics have always
been
political.
Yeah, always, any art is. If, you know,
like,
no matter what you do, there is some element of politics to it.
Yeah, Mario saves a princess by overthrowing a different kingdom.
Yeah.
Like, there's something inherently political about that, whether you want it or not.
Ta-Nehisi Coates writing Black Panther.
Yeah.
He was in town at Pitt a couple a month
Yona
ago.
Harvey's.
Yeah, and Yona, who I know, Yona invited Marcel and I over, so we got to meet Ta-Nehisi.
That's awesome.
There was his presentation that evening at Pitt that was kind of open to the public and I guess really horribly organized and whatever. But they did
Fire Festival.
Yeah. Don't think it was quite that bad. But in the afternoon, they did a Comics Black Panther specific panel in a room at, that was invite only, and Yona invited us. Ta-Nehisi is like 80 feet tall and incredibly intense. He was marvelous, really intense though. But he talked about, you know, writing Black Panther just as a political thing, and just, you know, it's problematic, like, given who he is and his politics and his beliefs. And he's writing a character who...
Who's an absolute monarch.
Who's a monarch. Yeah. Yeah, you know, like, there's not a whole lot of democracy and personal freedom in Wakanda, and that's never really been addressed.
Yeah, and that's, like, the arc that just wrapped up, like, that's what he took that, and he, like, was like, we're going to talk about this.
We're going to talk about this, yeah. So the politics have always been there, and I try to be... And I'm really incredibly left-wing. I don't know how obvious that is. I try to be open to genuine conversation and genuine dissent. And, you know, people can have different opinions and perceptions of things. But there's that point where you just... And I think this is true of both sides, where you just fall in line with... This is the accepted truth of something, and you don't question it. I'm also all about, you know... If you're going to be engaged, try to be informed. And there are places, I fully admit, I'm not as informed as I could be. So, you know, in the arts, in comics, as creators, if you are very different than me politically, you still have the right to write your stories and tell those stories and present your point of view.
Yeah.
So I try to be open. I try to be open to the idea that while I disagree with you, this is a story, and we can engage it on that level. Yeah, and it's that separating the creator from the art, and you run into that with books. You know, I run into that with music. You know, there are
music is particularly tough, and there are
terrible
men making some pretty good music.
second concert I ever saw in my life at Civic Arena in summer of 1978 was Ted Nugent. His first solo album is a core album of my youth. That concert was amazing for lots of reasons I won't talk about in a public forum. And I find him to be absolutely reprehensible as a human being these days.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ted. But you know, I
think he's one of our main subscribers.
Yeah, I figured that. That album is still a part of my youth, and I can still listen to it, and it still will touch all those buttons that hit me when I was 15 years old, and I have memories of that concert that are incredibly fond. And it's that, how do I separate my reaction to this? And I realize that this is nostalgic, and if I listen to it for the first time today, I don't know that I have the same reaction. If I know that about an artist before I hear them or see their art, it will affect the way I perceive that art.
Yeah.
I hear Bump and Grind on 96.1 Freak Show every Friday morning. I'm like, I love this song. Man, R. Kelly's a bad
guy. Yeah.
I'm not going to buy any of his music now.
And you run into that with comics as well. Frank Miller has gone directions I'm not real fond of politically. And boy, you know, 1986, dropping names here, I sat at a Holiday Inn with Bill Sienkiewicz and Frank Miller and Dave Sim and Bissett and Tottleman, who were doing Swamp Thing at the time. The Holiday Inn bar, having beers with those guys one night. Miller's Daredevil, his Dark Knight. Sin City I wasn't as into. I appreciated it from an artistic point of view, what he was doing. But man, there was a time Frank Miller just kind of do no wrong. And boy, for the last 20 years, all he's done is wrong. And once again, that's my personal perception of it. Things I like to read. And it's separating, how do I go back to that stuff and read it now, given what he's become. And I've become something. Yeah. I'm not the person I was then either. I mean, any of us, our consumption of art and music, you weigh those things out. What can I accept? All of that.
I think it's tricky when you have to, like, support it financially.
And that's the other thing. Like, sometimes, I'll feel like, man, I don't love this, but I want to give it my money so that
don't
think that, like, other things like this will sell. Fearless Defenders, when it came out, I was like, I hate this art. I hate it. I don't like it. But they made an all-female team, and God damn it, I'm going to read this book. I want to
support that, yeah.
I have no idea how good Wonder Woman is or isn't going to be, so I'll decide whether or not I'm going to see it around that time. But I'm like, I'll still buy a ticket and just have someone else go. Like, I want them to keep making these.
The trailers look good.
Yeah.
We'll see. She was the best part of Superman, Batman.
That's what I've heard,
way too late by the time she came in.
I mean, they released some new TV spots.
I hated that movie. Oh, my God. I hated that movie.
I just hate the defense.
Like, I'm not a hater.
I didn't see it, but I hate the people that are like, oh, you know, you just didn't like it because you're not a comics fan. I'm like, I know a lot of comics fans who hate that
movie. Yeah, I didn't like it because I'm a comics fan.
So it might be a bad movie.
I've read comics my entire life, and I didn't know who any of those people were.
They did not remotely resemble any of the people you've...
And I've had this conversation, too. It's like, you know, I can accept the Batman 66 TV show as Batman. I can accept the cartoon version as Batman. I can accept the Dark Knight version as Batman.
Like, they all have something of Batman in them.
Yeah, like, you know, it's not like I have this whole, this is my Batman and everything else is wrong. I'm open to lots and lots of interpretations.
What about Batman and Robin?
With the
live action,
I grew up with that stuff.
Mr. Freeze, I'm sorry.
No,
I love that so much.
Yeah, it's goofy as hell, but I love it. I grew up with that stuff.
That shaped the person I am today.
Yeah, and I think part of the success of Batman is as a character concept, as an archetype, he is big enough to hold all these different interpretations, and they're all valid.
They all feel possible at the same time.
And I watched that movie last year and went, "Who is this guy?" He's Iron Man, first of all, because he's a rich guy who it's all about his technology.
I feel like it was the writing, it wasn't Affleck. It's not that Affleck ruined it.
When I'm watching the movie, he wasn't Batman. He was Luthor in a Batman costume. His entire motivation was Lex Luthor's motivation, more than Lex Luthor's were.
Well, that was just Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah. Not because, you know, Lex Luthor's motivation has always been, here's this alien with all these powers.
Aren't we going to do something about it?
He's a threat to humanity. Yeah. Let's do something about it. And that was Batman's entire motivation in that movie.
Batman's just, I have a plan in case he goes rogue, but I don't really think he will.
And I'm fine with that, Batman being prepared for something like that.
That's not his motivation. He just does that.
Yeah, that's just like something he's like concerned about because he's a planner.
But then there's the other stuff of, like, you know, oh, that battle of Superman and Zod destroyed Metropolis. Look what happened. I don't want that to happen to my city. So to stop it from happening to my city, I'm going to set up an elaborate death trap on a building in my city and invite Superman over for a fight.
Sounds like a great plan.
I don't want Gotham destroyed, so let's fight him here in the middle of Gotham.
Yeah.
What?
And also, maybe Gotham should be destroyed.
Let's be real.
Your last name is Man, too? Let's hug it out, bro.
Wonder Woman, are we all friends? Cyborg. Cyborg and Flash, they're not part of the family. Yeah, one word names.
Even Wonder Woman.
What is this? What are you, like, Cher? Beyonce? With your
Wonder Woman? I was angry coming out of that movie.
But no, the Wonder Woman's trailers do look good. So
they do. They, you know,
I'm
they
hoping
look
it looks
there's
good.
There's even, like, there's color in them. Like,
my fear is all the good parts are in the trailer.
Yeah,
which would still make it better than Batman.
Yeah.
Just pound for pound.
But yeah, and it disappoints me because I enjoy seeing the movies, but I'm much more into the comics that I will ever be in the movies. I've been saying for years that as much as I like any of these movies, I've read better comics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, comics are much more my thing than movies are.
You can tell such a more intricate story.
Yeah, and that's part of it. It's just you can build so much more in terms of character and plot and all that stuff.
I typically really
enjoy the movies. You know, they're fun. I've waited my entire life to see these characters portrayed this way.
And they're portrayed very well.
And to see other people seeing them for the first time, being introduced to...
Because even like the TV shows and stuff, you know, Iron Fist, which I still haven't watched all of, it moved very slowly. And you know, all these people complaining about it. And yes, I think it is the worst of the four we've seen on Netflix. If that had been on TV 30 years ago, it would have been the greatest superhero show you've ever seen in your life. Because I remember superhero shows 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So I try to keep that in mind when I watch any of these. Mm-hmm. It's so much better than anything used to be.
Mm-hmm. The bar's been raised so much.
Yeah.
But because there's so much of it, we're also at that point where
it's competing against like non-superhero content too.
Because there's so much of it, we no longer have to be absolutely forgiving of things that are bad just because it's a superhero.
Yeah.
You know? Say 30 years ago, we watched Man from Atlantis because that was the only thing on TV.
I think the key thing when you're putting something like on the screen versus on the page is that you have to appreciate the medium difference for it. It's like you can't just tell the story one for one.
No, you're absolutely right.
I think Deadpool is a good adaptation, and the Scott Pilgrim books I really liked. I mean, even though the story was completely diverged at the fourth X into something different. Yeah. I thought it was still
entertaining.
Shown very well.
Watchmen is the prime example of that. Alan Moore was on record for years that he felt Watchmen was unfilmable as a movie. Mm-hmm. And when I went to see Watchmen, and I agreed with that for lots and lots of reasons. They're different mediums. Just the things, to me, the things that made...
The way the story is told is such like a weird, like non-linear...
It is such... The things that make Watchmen work are so specific to comic book storytelling that they do not translate to film. Much like things that work in film just don't translate to comics. They're different storytelling mediums. And I went to see the movie, and I liked it much better than I expected to, but I also felt it proved his point. The book was unfilmable. and one of the reasons I use that as an example is, in the world of comics, Watchmen is a complete and utter game-changing... Whether you like it or not, historically, it's pre and post Watchmen. Yeah, it changed the way people talked about superheroes and the way people talked about comics and the way people told stories in comics. As a movie, it was a fun summer film.
But
they bring people to the book.
Yeah, and then that's it. We sold a ton of that book after. So, as being a successful movie in bringing people to comics, hooray. I think they could do a much better job making a 12-episode TV series.
Yeah,
give me
like
an episode per book.
I don't feel like... I feel like that's possible now. It definitely could... I don't think that could have worked when it came out. Like, also, I guess there was no Netflix either, so...
Yeah, there wouldn't have been a form for that at the time, but...
I do like the episodic shows. I wish they weren't an hour. That feels... Like, I loved Luke Cage. I wanted to support Black Heroes, but I'm like, man, this is really good, but this is taking a long time to get the first episode. And then it's like, I could watch the new Bill Nye and get halfway through it in the same amount of time that it would take me to do a few episodes. So it is interesting to see the formats change, though.
Yeah.
Scott Pilgrim's still one of my favorite movies. I think they adapted that.
And I agree.
Edgar Wright's like,
because it wasn't a full adaptation, it was an interpretation, but it captured the feel of it.
Yeah, it had the like the comic booky kind of like video game aspect.
Yeah.
That like integrated it really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was a good idea like to write a comic that was pretty much reality augmented via video game language.
Yeah.
So when you adapt it to film, you're like, well, we can draw from the video game stuff and the comic stuff and other things
utilize
as well.
Both. Yeah.
And then, I mean, they had a video game that was completely different from those two. So, and they all three were, none of them were as good as the comic, the source material, but they were all enjoyable in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of...
Well, and they complemented each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, the movie ended completely different than the book, and I'm like, this is better than a poor representation of the comic.
Yeah.
This is just a different story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I
you're
like it.
A different story with the same character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it really worked out. Nah.
And that's
great
fine.
Humor, so...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But also, I guess that's what happens when you decide to write your movie when you're not done producing the comic. So,
Game of Thrones syndrome. Like.
Yeah, so like they're diverging too, right?
Yeah.
Mm, Walking Dead,
the
probably.
Last season, yeah. Walking Dead's probably got a...
Two mini-seasons?
Yeah. I'm still enjoying Walking Dead as a TV show. That's and this is the comic book metaphor. It's not a straight adaptation of the comics either. They follow a general timeline.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't
and there's similarities,
the
so it's like it's you know the comic is Walking Dead Earth 1 and the TV show is Earth 2, and I do still enjoy both of them for different reasons, and in some ways it feels like they've gone on too long, but they still, the book more than the show still manages to surprise me from time to time, and in the show they're just it kind of boils down to, and I'm like this with anything, it's I have to be invested in characters.
Yeah.
Or it just doesn't hold me. And there's a couple characters on the show that I just feel really very invested
that you really
in.
Really care about.
Yeah.
Any favorites?
Carol's my favorite person on the show.
Carol's pretty hardcore.
Her story arc, I think, has just been remarkable. In the comics, she was a footnote. You know? And just seeing her go from abused woman to warrior has been a fascinating character arc for me. Without losing her humanity. And that's one of the issues they're dealing with her is how do I survive here and do the things I need to do and not lose my humanity?
Mm-hmm.
And I think just as an actress, I think I'm blanking on her name.
I don't watch the show, so I don't know.
Boy, I feel really bad now. Just dead zone.
It's tricky.
Sorry.
I find her performance so compelling. Just she so embodies that character and the emotions that are going on there. So,
Daryl, he's not even from the comics.
Melissa McBride.
Yes.
Yeah.
Norman Reedus I saw in an episode of Law and Order because everyone is in Law and Order. And I'm like, is that? And it's weird because you see it and then you don't think about it. Then you see the show that they're also in and then you see it again. Like, is that Daryl?
Yeah.
That's Daryl.
I've done that with different things. You start seeing those same faces in different shows.
And it's always like from way before they were ever in like whatever their big thing is. Like once you're the lead of Walking Dead, you're not doing bit parts as like the rapist of the week on SVU. Like
but
it's so bad that they use their own actors and actresses. Like their main DA for the longest, I think Casey. She was also like a criminal earlier in the show.
Yeah,
and like same actress, different person. Like
they did that on Doctor Who with Martha. Martha in the last episode of, I think it was Martha. She was in the last episode of the first of like Rose's season.
Yeah, just as, like
Oh yeah, my cousin was in that. Yeah. Like
yeah.
Oh, your cousin who was your clone.
Well, like, and they had to explain Peter Capaldi appearing in that the episode with Donna.
But
why do I have this face?
I love when universes like
within the last year or so I went back and rewatched all of the Doctor Who stuff from Eccleston on.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, the number of Game of Thrones people who are also on Doctor Who, kind of remarkable.
Man, I would love to go back and rewatch them. I did once, but it's just like it seems almost like a different like time of my life almost.
Yeah.
Like the time that I was like so into Doctor Who. Yeah. And like the first like 4 to 5 seasons of it, I was just like so obsessed.
Yeah.
And now it's just kind of like a show I watch. Like I'll catch up on.
Yeah,
like I haven't watched this season.
I mean,
episodes.
And
yet, but I'm catch
Doctor
up.
Who's
like,
one of those things that it feels like I've known about forever.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't readily available in the TV market when I was growing up, so I was aware of it through comics and just general fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I saw a couple of random episodes, primarily of.
And it's one
Fourth
of those
Doctor.
Things that are that's like it's so hard. Even if there are clear entry points, like, you don't, like, you're like, oh, well, this is the 9th Doctor, do I have to start with the first Doctor
years
ago?
Yeah, and I think it is, you know, starting with a Doctor and then being able to go back, because I started with the 9th, and that was one of those, working in the comic shop, being involved in fandom, who is so much more popular in the States now than it was
ever.
But, you know, those handful of Who fans were so fervent about it that I found myself having one of those reactions. Oh, it's just, I don't care, whatever.
Yeah, you're like, ugh.
And a really good friend of mine, Steve Siegel, Steve was editor in Pittsburgh, which was the weekly paper here before City Paper, and I wrote freelance for them. Steve came in as an arts editor, so I met him just through email as, hey, this is your new arts editor.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came into the store like a week later because he was a comics fan. And,
like, okay.
And we developed a friendship after that. And he has gone on. He's worked with Quirk Books and was the editor when they rebooted Weird Tales a few years ago.
Oh, nice.
And Steve, just a big Goober fanboy. But Steve's also one of the biggest Doctor Who fans I know. And for all my resistance, he kept poking away. And when when they rebooted it, I didn't watch it. And he's like, just forget everything went before you. Start with Eccleston. Just watch
start
it.
There. Yeah.
And like 3 episodes in, he's like, ah, damn it, he's right. And I was
yeah.
right. And so I've watched all of it since then. And
I
liked Eccleston, but that was very much, here's my introduction to that universe. So
mm-hmm.
I didn't feel the connection.
Mm-hmm.
Got really, really into Tennant.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Smith kind of lost me.
Yeah. But I think it was the writing more than his Doctor.
Yeah. Even there was some... and in rewatching it, I appreciated it more the second time around than I did the first. Maybe it's just because he's an older Doctor. Capaldi has clicked with me just really.
Yeah, I feel like I've come back to the show since...
Yes, and he was, you know, he was cranky and whatever that first season, and I think he was trying to find his place. But I think there were story reasons for that as well, but there's, without elaborating way, way, way too much with his time and whatever, there are elements of his character and his portrayal, and even clothing and stuff that just, for whatever reason, is clicking with me more than any of them have.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really going to miss him being a part of this.
Yeah.
There are still some of the elements of the writing, the Moffat era stuff, that are still problematic.
Yeah.
But his performance has transcended that for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My funny Comic-Con story from last year is that we were standing by, like, the escalator waiting for, like, waiting to meet a friend. And this guy comes down the escalator in, like, the most baller 12th Doctor cosplay I've ever seen in my life. Like, with the sunglasses and, like, the coat and everything, goes down. And I realize as he goes past me that he's surrounded by, like, con gophers. And I was like, and some other guy looked at me. He goes, "Is that?" And I was like, "Oh my god, it is!" And it was Capaldi just walking around. It was actually him. Like, he was wearing his Doctor costume at the con.
I feel like you pointed, like, "That's Peter Capaldi." I'm like, "I don't know. What does that mean to me?"
Like, what the hell is that? Yeah, I remember when I started watching Doctor Who, I watched the first episode, like, in the middle of finals week, and I thought, I can't watch any more of this until I've passed my test.
So you have more, strength than me. I think it's one I have to do with Homestuck. I'm just skip right to Act 2. Just jump right in and act like I don't know what the first part is. Do you have any notes we wanted to go over?
Well, I wanted to ask a little bit about the Toonzeum.
You can tell a whole lot about that. That was the Toonzeum fundraiser last year.
Nice. Got the look.
Well, and that was it. Say the clothes. I have had a frock coat for 15 years, and in the fall and spring, I wear it with a hoodie under it. So, like, he first started doing this, like,
you're like,
perfect.
You're cosplaying me.
You stole my look.
So now, anytime I do that, I feel like I stealth cosplay.
I get to wear my Finn jacket everywhere. Like, I have a leather jacket from The Force Awakens, and people are like, "Nice jacket." I'm like, "Yeah, it's Star Wars." And like, really?
Just,
I'm like,
I've never been a giant fashion plate, but the look of the frock coat I've always liked, and just years ago I bought one, and just, you know, it changed up the look of, you know, wedding, funeral, gunfight, I'm ready for whatever breaks out.
Exactly.
You know? And then I, you know, Capaldi started cosplaying me, so okay.
There you go. Yeah.
Wedding, funeral, gunfight. I like the trifecta.
That's amazing.
That's my WFG crew. Yeah, Steph had a few questions about the Toonzeum, if we could.
Oh, yeah,
sure. Like, if you just talk a little bit about your involvement there.
Okay.
How you got into...
Yeah.
I guess,
well,
what is it, first off?
And then, yeah, the Toonzeum is in downtown Pittsburgh. It's one of very few museums in the country dedicated to the cartoon arts, comics and animation and comic strips and anything that qualifies with that.
Political cartoons.
This is the 10th year of it. It started as, it was a hallway in the Children's Museum on the north side. The founder was Joe Woese, who was the original executive director. And it started out as just this idea that kind of grew.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved with them just as a fan, probably within the first year of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And have gone to events, and I've helped them with various things. I've been on the board for a little over 2 years now. I was invited to join, say, 2 years ago. It's a museum, and I mean, it's very small, you know, and it's a non-profit, so there's always the ongoing issues of funding and you're trying to put together shows. We are trying to move to a more educational model, not focus so much just on exhibition. And we've always done a little bit of that, provide workshops and talks and
that
sort of thing.
Cool.
But we're looking into more comics in the classroom. There's some organizations around the country.
Kind of.
Yeah. And that's a mix of just wanting to expand and shake up what we do, but also just, you know, mercenary. It opens up more funding sources.
Exactly.
You know? So there's some of that. It's something I really believe in. I believe comics are art, and I think there's that level of appreciation that people don't... You hand somebody a comic, and I think they're immediately accessible, but a lot of people still have that, this is trash pop culture, and who cares?
Yeah, like, this is just, like...
But if you frame it and put it on a wall in a museum, and people go, ooh, art. it changes the context, and if that context change can bring them to the actual comics, I think that's a good thing. It goes back to me being a missionary for comics.
You've met some cool people, too. Like, you met John Lewis.
Yeah, that was the biggest event we ever had. And that exhibit is still up. It's at the Toonzeum now.
Okay.
It premiered at the August Wilson. The March series of graphic novels, which are biographies of John Lewis, who was one of the speakers on the day of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still a congressman.
Still a badass.
Still a badass. still, heavily involved in the civil rights movement back in the day. I mean, he was in the March on Selma. He was arrested, you know, just he was one of the freedom riders, all that stuff. Put together, and I had to fully admit I had nothing to do with putting this organization, this exhibit or anything together. I was there on the board. Yay, we're doing this.
Sounds like a great idea.
Rob Rogers, who is was the board president, he just cycled off, and he's local political cartoonist for the Post Gazette. Mm-hmm. But he's known everywhere in that realm. He was involved with it. Sylvia Rohr, who teaches at Carlo. Sylvia had done some background information on. There was a comic book that was published in 1957 called The Montgomery Story. It was a biography of Martin Luther King that came out in 1957. It was done in comics format. As part of that, part of the art in that was drawn examples of passive resistance, how to engage in passive resistance. And they did in comics form because it's visual. Here are things you can do visually. But also, you know, lots and lots of people in the South, people of color in the South who were part of the civil rights movement, just because of the system, a lot of them were illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just because of bad schools and all the things that go into the racist things they were fighting against. As a comic, as a visual, it was a way to teach those things to people of minimal reading skills.
Mm-hmm.
John Lewis saw that comic. It motivated him to reach out and contact Martin Luther King, which started his life in the civil rights movement. We had him and the creators. My mind, I'm getting old and my mind blanks on stuff. We'll fill that in.
Yeah.
And I will probably think of it as I'm talking. But they came in and they did a presentation at the August Wilson Center. We had the art there. The exhibit included reproductions of the Montgomery Story, which is in the public domain. You can go online and find it and download it.
Yeah, actually, it was funny. I saw the John Lewis exhibit, not because I had realized it was there, but because me and my mom had gone to see the costumes from the Wiz.
Yeah. It's at the same time, yeah.
And we came down and we were like, oh, wow, this is awesome. Like, let's look at this, too.
So you had reproductions of that. We had reproductions of pages from March, which is John Lewis's story, and then in between the two were political cartoons from the civil rights era, which was a really nice linkage.
From both sides too, right?
Yeah.
Like.
And you know, what was really striking about that was this is stuff from 50 plus years ago, and it's as pertinent right now as it was then, which is a little depressing and discouraging.
Yeah.
You know, like we keep having to relearn these same lessons. But here I got to spend some time with John Lewis in the green room at the August Wilson Center, me and some of the other Tunisian people, before he went on to speak.
Andrew Aiden and Nate Powell.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Andrew Aiden and Nate Powell.
You spent time with John Lewis.
But, so just in the green room before he went on, and I've met lots and lots of people in my life and famous people and whatever. Mm-hmm. I rarely feel in awe of someone when I'm in their presence, and he's one of them.
Like, larger than life. Like.
Just larger than life. Just, he's here, you know, sitting there, just a human being eating a sandwich, and you embody this entire era. Oh,
what a sandwich. What a
you just embody this entire area. Your experiences are things I will never experience. You are a living piece of American history in ways that most people never are. And to hear someone of that stature say the sentence, "A comic book changed my life," kind of justifies everything I've ever done.
Comics helped in the civil rights movement, which is why you should buy Wonder Woman number 5.
Yeah, it was powerful, and his presentation was powerful as well. And yes, he's still a badass. One of the other people in comics that I felt that way about. I did the last public interview with Jerry Robinson, who created Robin and the Joker. And when Batman was filming in Pittsburgh, he came into town.
Cool.
He did a signing at Phantom. He actually did a signing at Kiva Han on the corner because he was 91 years old and couldn't get up our steps. And Kiva Han, the cool coffee shop that was there at the time, which is more than accommodating. It was a nice day. They set a table out.
Uh-huh.
But he did a slideshow presentation at the Toon Zeum that I was invited to moderate. It was before mm-hmm. I was on the board, but comics historian guy.
Yeah.
So they asked me to moderate that. So, and just, he was marvelous. And, you know, once again, just here's this guy who, he created Robin.
Yeah,
here's this thing we take, so he created the Joker.
Yeah, you pretty much have changed comic books by yourself.
And he's telling these stories of, you know, he's talking, you know, to me, like Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, these guys have created Superman. They're legends in this industry, and their names and whatever. They were his friends. He's talking about double dating with Jerry Siegel, you know. And just like, this is just your life, you know, uh-huh. and you're talking about it. And once again, you embody this world that has become so much of my life
mm-hmm.
and so much of the metaphor I use to interact with the world. Mm. He was marvelous. He was so smart and so well spoken. And aside from creating those characters, he was one of the people leading the fight for creators' rights back in the early days. He really helped Siegel and Shuster get some of the settlements they got from DC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
So yeah, so there's the other pieces of it. And Jerry died less than 6 months after that.
Oh wow!
So it was his last public appearance.
You being a part of history yourself.
Yeah. I keep brushing up against it.
You're like leaning up against history.
Well, and I will say, I had a friend just on Facebook yesterday, just, you know, sort of those questions. Hey, have you ever met anybody famous? And he's getting uh-huh. all kinds of lists. And he knows people who have gone into acting and whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's a neat list. But it made me start thinking about just through, I grew up in a hollow in Green County, south 850 miles, you know, mm-hmm. Appalachian country boy.
Yeah.
I'm from Green County?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, you said Washington, Marianna. Yeah. Western end, I'm right on the Washington County line, but about as far west as you can go in Green County.
Okay.
Okay.
I probably know the town. We'll have to bring it up afterwards.
yeah, when you said Marianna, it's like, oh, okay. I know where that is. My ancestors, the Wise family name, settled in Marianna. There's a house there. In 1747,
oh, wow.
the Weiss family came and settled in Maryland and then moved to Pennsylvania. And Johann Weiss, Wise, was buried behind the house in Marianna in 17 whatever. So I've seen the tombstones. So,
lovely little neighborhood.
Yeah, my family's been here forever. But being from there, through my writing, through being involved in comics and whatever, I've had the opportunity to meet some really, really neat people.
Mm-hmm.
Just Marcel and I talking about that. You know, I grew up in a hollow in Green County. Marcel's very overtly Pittsburgh Hill and Homewood, and, you know, just mm-hmm. Pittsburgh, you know, urban. And we're sitting there with John Lewis, like, how did we end up here? You know, yeah, like, this is pretty awesome. We are here.
It's funny thing about the, like, how you get to some places in your life, whether they're like fantastic or just like run of the mill. But
yeah,
how is it that the three people in this room, given our backgrounds and circumstances, just even if it's not meeting someone famous, it's just like, What a weird set of circumstances.
Yeah,
to get
right the
here
connections.
At this point,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by those things. And Facebook has made, you can track those connections
uh-huh.
in ways you couldn't 20 mm-hmm. years ago. Just how do people know each other?
It's kind of scary, but also really cool.
Yeah, like I'm fascinated by those connections and how people know each other, and that whole, you know, if you know seven people, you know everybody on the planet. And,
mm-hmm,
and there's the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing. And
I feel like almost everybody's that has to be 7 degrees.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
We know a guy who knows Chadwick, so.
And when you get to a town the size of Pittsburgh, it's, you know, 1 degree.
Yeah, like, well, I was in a meeting the other day in my new publishing job in New York City, and one of the books I'm working on is set in Western Pennsylvania, and the girl from marketing in this meeting, who I had never met before, I was like, oh, I'm from Pittsburgh area. And I was like, oh, where from? And she was like, Wexford. And I was like, I worked in the Cranberry Barnes & Noble for 2 years of my life. Like,
yeah.
It's that small.
In 1999, a friend and I did a cross-country drive. Went to visit a friend who lived in Los Angeles. And just, it was a 10-day adventure. We get there. Like, basically, he lives there. His parents lived here. His father, who owns a business in
had some money, had bought him a new SUV that we were delivering to him and driving the old one back. But it's someone we knew, so, you know, so it was also a vacation. So we go there and we, you know, hang out in the desert for a couple of days doing touristy things and fun things. We get to Los Angeles and our the brand new SUV is covered in an inch of Arizona dust. Like, let's run this through a car wash before we get to Terry's house. And it's just, it's one of those automated car washes. We're sitting outside while it goes through on the track, and we're just sitting there talking. There's a woman on a bench waiting for her car. The SUV comes out. It has Pennsylvania license plates on it. And the woman sitting next to us says, "Pennsylvania, Yin's guy's from Pittsburgh."
Yes. We can't get away from
it. Yes, we are. First person we speak to in Los Angeles, Yin's guy's from Pittsburgh.
It's, you know, Steelers country isn't a joke. Like, the whole entire state that she could have guessed. Pittsburgh,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, how'd you tell? That's hilarious. The Pittsburgh accent is definitely...
We're joining a new party that our DM from the one D&D game is starting another campaign, and so we're, like, still character building, and we're trying to figure out, like, what the most, like, incongruous accent my tiefling could speak would be. And I was like, we were like, Valley Girl. Like, I was like, oh my god, imagine a Yinzer.
I was playing Overwatch with some buddies, and they do a D&D campaign. And they have, like, this, in their words, like, a very redneck hillbilly elf. Like, these two sets of them. And they're, hey, man, we gotta get out here. Like, oh, look at him. He's not even afraid. He's just sleeping while there's people attacking. Like, they didn't understand how magic worked. And they weren't, like, playable characters. They were just NPCs that just followed them around. And I'm like, that feels right outside of Pittsburgh, you know? So that's good stuff. Good stuff. Do you want to jump into, like, do you have any other questions?
I don't have any other, like, interview questions, but I put the list of...
We
rapid fire, if you want to.
Do you have a few minutes?
We can
do it. We have a rapid fire section. We call rapid it that.
Okay.
We don't have a quirky name for it. Maybe a spin dash section or something. But we have some of these. If you want to jump into some of these.
These are questions that we ask, like, in a way that's, it's kind of like testing your nerd cred, but not in like a gatekeepery way. Just kind of like,
yeah,
like quantitative rather than qualitative, I guess. But there's always kind of, like, goofy questions, but, like, so one of my favorites is, what's your favorite iteration of the Joker? It's the hard one.
As problematic as it is today, I really loved Killing Joke when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, I'm fully aware of the problematic aspects of it. Part of that is, I love Brian Boland's art.
Mm-hmm.
So well,
that's true of so many, like, classic comics, like...
Yeah, so there's that one panel where he's holding his head and laughing, that to me, that is the epitome, that's the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
I love the animated series one, though.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an overall, kind of him kind of incorporating all the different aspects of it. The more violent and weird he gets, the less I'm interested.
I got one. Who would you want to play you in a show or movie?
Peter Capaldi. No.
He's already stealing your looks.
Yes, he's stealing my look, so why not? Many years ago, I'd have said Gene Wilder. these days, I'm not too sure.
I just
think you
can pull anybody from history.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be current.
Yeah, Gene Wilder. The kid who played Hyde on That 70s Show, because that's what I look like in the 70s.
The origin story.
Yay, right.
And the follow-up, who would you want to play in a TV show or movie?
Oh. Boy, that's a good question. I'd like to do my take on Doctor Who.
That would be awesome.
Probably won't get that chance.
There's still time.
Yeah. Just, like, increase the number of...
Yeah. Iterations.
Iterations. I know we're exhausted by crossovers, but if you could cross over any two anythings, what would you cross over?
Well, I've seen so many well-done ones.
I know, this one always is like...
When, you know, early 80s, they did that X-Men Teen Titans crossover, which at that time... Cool. Those were my two favorite books at that time, and that was one of those one-shot crossovers where everything I wanted...
Was right.
Like they did it. They actually got it right. These days, I don't know. I don't know that I'm invested in any of them.
Even have to be comics. Like, it could be like...
Yeah, the drawing I did for the Toonzeum exhibit was Betty and Veronica versus Alien, so...
I like that. I'd probably watch that. How about... what superpower would you want to have for a week?
Luck.
Solid. Luck manipulation can make anything happen.
Just things, like... things happening to my in my favor. It's a subtle power, but...
So would it just be you have increased luck, or would you like have luck manipulation?
Would it be like Scarlet Witch kind of like probability manipulation?
Yeah, kind of more things like... just going my way.
Okay.
Like Felix Felicis.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That was Jinx from the Teen Titans and Scarlet Witch essentially the same character. Is this probability magic?
Yeah.
She changes probability. But basically well, she shoots beams at people.
Anecdote with that. Several years ago, I was out hanging out all day with my closest friends and their kids, who are my godchildren, who are now, they're in their early 20s. But they were probably, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, something like that at the time. And earlier in the day, we were talking, and my godson asked me that question, what power superpower do you want to have? So I'm trying to explain to him the luck thing. And he's a really bright kid. So he got it, but it's not like flying or super strength. Later that afternoon, we're going to the Children's Museum. We get there. Their dad has the membership to all the museums in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. It didn't include
the
Children's Museum. So it was going to be really expensive. But, you know, one of my customers was working at the desk gave us tickets. At which point...
He was like, are you sure you don't already have
That's it. His mom's like, you know, that luck power Wayne was telling you about? That's it.
That's how you make a fan for life.
On the flip side of that, if you had, like, if you... Say you're in the X-Men universe and you have a mutation that counts as a mutation. Like, you're not fully human. You're a mutant. But it's not the kind of power that gets you on the X-Men. Like, if it's, like, shitty
what,
X-Men.
What second-tier power?
Yeah, what second-tier power would be your superpower?
Oh. Wow. Yeah.
When I was working at Barnes & Noble, my example that I always say is that, like, it would be being confused for someone else named Bethany, like being undercover, as, like, being able to, like, convince people that I was Bethany. I actually got Bethany'd last week at work for the first time in, like, 2 weeks, or, like, 2 years. Bethany'd. Like, people call you and say, oh, no, like, hi, this is Stephanie, how can I help you? And they're like, hey, Bethany, there's an alternate person.
Would that be like garbage luck manipulation?
Yeah. it's like being able to change into any other, like, to modify who you are, like convince people that you're someone else, but you're only ever able to convince them that you're someone that looks exactly like you, but your name is Bethany.
Like when Lex Luthor became the Flash and he didn't know who the Flash was underneath the mask. I have no idea who this is.
I mean, the ability to change your eye color, right? You know, something,
yeah,
something
sounds
like that.
That'd be solid. Who's
the ability to clean up without doing anything.
That would get you in the X-Men mansion. I don't know if you'd be on the team.
You'd be on the team. You'd just be the janitor.
After the fight, yes. We were in the danger room again. Okay, good. Thanks.
Did I don't have to do anything? It's good. Cool, we could probably close out with a few more. I'm running out of battery. Real quick, GIF or JIF?
I've always said GIF.
Cool. And
and here's my thing, is it's an abbreviation for graphics, not graphics.
That's what I say. And then as an engineer, the creator's an engineer, and he says JIF, and I'm like, engineers are bad at English, don't listen to us. Like, don't listen to what he's saying. That's... And he has his domain rights, but...
And if he created it, he gets to pick. That's same thing. Uh-huh. Hellblazer. It's John Constantine.
Constantine?
Nobody says it that way, but I can point out to the panel to you where he explains how to pronounce his name in his first appearance in Swamp Thing.
I mean, if it's canonized, then we're all just wrong.
At the time, I was hanging out with Steve Bissett and John Tottleben, who were drawing Swamp Thing, and they essentially created the character, and they said John Constantine. It's a battle I've stopped fighting in the store.
that's fair.
But I can show you the panel where he explains how to pronounce his name.
It's a good thing we decided not to.
Yeah.
Do you want to close with any questions?
think that's good to wrap up.
Okay, well, all right. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, really absolutely. Appreciate it. It's fun.
Do you have, like, any kind of online presence or anything? Or?
I have a blog, which is wayne-wise.com. Okay. I have a Twitter account that I barely use because I can't quite wrap my head around Twitter.
We're on there. We can
barely. Facebook, obviously. But mainly my blog. I have two main blogs, one of which is just me rambling about whatever crosses my mind. The other is a more specific comics-based blog where I talk about, like, some of the things I talk about in my class and elaborate on more... not quite academic, but smarter takes on comics rather than just reviewing Batman or whatever.
Yeah.
So cool. And then you can find that from the Wayne-Wise blog.
Awesome. We'll put it in the show notes. But hey, we want to thank you again for your time. And the details where to find us from the show notes because we're running out of battery. But hey, so this has been another episode of Character Reveal. You know, you can always visit Family Attic if you're in Pittsburgh. Support your local comic business. And thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
And, until next time, see you later.
Bye.
Bye.